Hey listeners, welcome to Trust in Tech, where we have conversations with folks helping the internet and society thrive. Alice here. This episode is a bit different. Instead of getting deep into the weeds with a guest, we're actually starting from the beginning. You see, I get a lot of questions from people who are fascinated by trust and safety and integrity work in tech, and they want to know, what does it look like? How can I do it too? What kinds of jobs are out there? How do I get a job? So I thought I'd answer some of these questions here on the podcast. Let me know what you think. Our guest today, Perlewe Zigwe, is going to talk about Tech Policy 101. Also, check out the show notes of this episode. I'll put a bunch of resources about tech policy in there for you as well. As a reminder, the views stated in this episode are not affiliated with any organization and only represent the views of the individuals. I hope you enjoy the show. Perlewe, do you want to introduce yourself and give our listeners a bit of a brief background of who you are?
Sure. Hi, Alice. Thank you so much for having me on this podcast. I'm a huge fan. So to everyone listening, my name is Perlewe Zigwe, and I guess by background, I feel like I've insisted in a way that everyone refers to me as Beyonce of Tech Policy because I'm a huge fan of Beyonce, and I figured, who else would I want to apply her work ethics into the tech policy space? So that's pretty much in summary of who I am. And then the long form is that I am Nigerian and I'm currently living in my fourth country in London. And my background is legal, so I'm a lawyer. And I got into tech policy in 2019. And so far I've worked with TikTok, briefly with Twitter, and now I'm with the Oversight Board. I'm looking forward to discussing more about the tech policy space, local policies, and so much more questions that people have definitely asked about getting into this space.
And I'll also shout out your newsletter, which is great. So if anybody wants to follow you along after this conversation, then you should look up the newsletter. It's a good mix of personal tips, professional tips, insights.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Into all things tech policy, yes. So more to come once I've figured out my life in London. Yes.
So tech policy, we'll go into a bit of a deeper dive at the end of this episode for anybody who isn't sure exactly what it means or wants more of an introduction. But we're going to start with localized policies. And so I'd love to hear a little bit of an introduction from you about why is it important? Why is it critical to have localized policies? And what do people need to know about that?
When I first started in tech policy, I didn't even know there were things or we could actually bucket policies into local because I always just knew about the global policy. So when people talk about tech policy, like the first thing that comes to mind or what I usually describe as tech policy is like the community guidelines. So whenever you go to a platform, you know, there are a set of rules that like rules of engagement where, you know, what can a user do or not do while engaging on the platform. To me, and to everybody probably listening, will probably just think that, okay, these are just like a set of rules and nothing more. But, you know, depending on the company, you know, they have like internal policies, and some of these internal policies might be global. And then there are some companies that have them local. So while I worked at TikTok, I was the policy manager for Sub-Saharan Africa. And I was very specific, as you can hear, like it was just specific to Africa. So what that meant was that eventually we'd had to create local policies or localized policies or make certain exceptions for users. And so that's how I kind of came about, or I started learning more about what local policies were, because companies like TikTok, wanted to lean local. They wanted to have a more local lens into the type of policies they were drafting for users and just kind of taking into more context how our users are using the platform, you know, depending on the region, depending on their culture and setting specifications. So that was why that was basically how I got into learning about like local policies. That's the first thing I can say about that.
It makes so much sense because so many tech companies are US based, but the world is not exactly like America. Yes. People, the way that people use social media, what they use it for, the way that they communicate, Very, very different. The first thing that comes to my mind that is obvious is U.S. racial politics, and the way that people in the U.S. think about race is very different to everywhere else in the world. Exactly. And we often think of it as being the default. Mm-hmm. And it just doesn't work globally. Do you have examples of like other bad policies or areas where it's really, really important to have a local context? What are some things that have gone wrong?
So I wouldn't necessarily say wrong, just in order to not call out like companies and all or maybe subjects anywhere. What I would say is that with like examples, I think the first thing that comes to mind is like cultural nudity. So while I worked at TikTok as a policy manager, like the first thing, one of the first few policies that I kind of worked on was just on cultural nudity, right? There are certain countries that allow nudity. So, as we know, like in most community standards, they're just like, well, we do not allow nudity on the platform. If a user is found, distributing content of whether it's nude men or women, this type of content will be taken down. But we then realized that there are certain countries that, it's permissible depending on the event. Perfect example is in Southern African countries. There are ceremonies where women go about bare-chested, and it's completely fine. It's not sexualized. It's just part of culture. It also is very common in the Aborigine region. That's all the way in Australia. So these are normal phenomenons for women or men alike. And I'm sure there are also countries where everyone is actually nude. So it didn't make sense that we just had one set of policies addressing that. And so what we did was just to kind of create policies that would accommodate these type of exceptions. And so basically we had to understand the context. Like I said, in Southern Africa, it was usually during a ceremony. So it's like, okay, when do we usually have these ceremonies? Is it in the summertime? When do we need to start making accommodations for these ceremonies and drafting policies around that? So these are type of policies and exceptions that we would have to make. Another one would also be in terms of gender orientation or identity. So as you can see, like the world is increasingly taking notes and, having a conversation around gender and, how you identify yourself. And so, beyond the him, her, she, her, there are a lot of users who identify themselves or who are going through, a transformation, either it's, trans women, trans men, what does that look like? And so just again, we didn't want to just like stick to the normal narrative. And so that's like trying to open up and trying to understand if a user is identifying or they are non-conforming, how do we accommodate that? If there are examples of certain nudity and this person happens to be in transition from male, for example, woman to male, what would that look like? What kind of exceptions do we need to make? What are the qualifiers? What do we need to look out for? So these are type of policies that we were drafting that I was a part of, and just also having examples and working really closely with civil society, because again, we don't have all the answers. And I think to anyone listening, it's just like realizing that as a policy manager, or if you're head in tech or, head of the trust and safety team, like you don't need to have all the answers, because as the world is moving, like it can be a bit confusing, just like what are qualifiers to look out for. So working really closely with like NGOs, CSOs who have, or even actually on the ground, it's a good way to get more answers and ways to draft our policies accordingly. And also have them maybe have like a seating, kind of conversation where it's okay, this is like a draft policy we're trying to work on. What are your thoughts? Another example would also be alcohol and drugs. So in certain community standards, to a large extent, like depending on what is like, some companies don't mind if you're displaying, well, not hard drugs per se, but let's say like weed, for example, which is kind of legalized in certain areas in the US, that if you were having a video and you were smoking that would probably be allowed. However, in certain conservative markets, this would not be allowed, so not even be tolerated, to be honest. And so that, in that situation, these are another set of ways that we have to draft policies. And companies do that. You know, it's not just TikTok that I worked for. And there are a lot of companies that will sit down and say, okay, based on this region and knowing just how sensitive their government is, knowing how sensitive their laws are, we would not allow these type of videos or content to, you know, permeate into that region. And so they will draft policies accordingly. So these are examples of like localized policies that usually are made with a lot of tech companies when it comes to understanding context and like different regions that are actually under their buckets or market.
I'm going to go back to the nipples for a second, because that is my soapbox.
It's a fun one. Yes.
Yeah, it's such a good one. I'm so glad that you brought up that example. So I work for Grindr, which is the world's largest LGBTQ platform. So we think really, really deeply about gender and identity. That's our niche. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one thing that pretty early on when I started working at Grindr, I noticed that we had guidelines for nipples, male nipples allowed, female nipples not allowed. That's according to Google and Apple's overall guidelines on nudity. We can't have pornography or nudity on Grindr because we need to be distributed by the app platforms. And we don't want pornography publicly anyway. So we have to draw the line somewhere. So that was where the line was. But I noticed that we were getting quite a few appeals from users who were saying, hey, I'm non-binary and I don't identify as female, and yet you still rejected my photo. And when I looked a little bit deeper, I saw that our moderators were approving photos, looking at photos and double-checking based on our nipple policy, but they didn't have any indicator of what the gender was. Or the self-identified gender of the person. So they were just looking at this picture with no additional context. And there are a lot of people on Grindr who are non-binary, as you said, transitioning. And you could look at a picture and say, okay, I see some breast tissue. I'm going to assume that this is a female. But then you look at the person's profile and they're like, I'm non-binary, or I'm a trans man. And you can't make that assumption just based on what you're looking at. So we added gender as a little information section underneath every single photo. So now when moderators are looking at pictures, they have the context right there without having to click into the full profile and see everything. And that really helps them make a much more informed decision. And there are some times where people don't tell us what their gender is, and then our moderators have to still guess the gender, which is not fair to the person. It's not fair to the moderators. And so I'm very much pro free the nipple for our context, at least. I think, you know, it's an app for 18 and over adults. Nobody, I don't think, is going to be completely offended by a nipple, and having gender free rules makes things a lot easier for everybody to understand. But we still have to live within App Store guidelines, so we're not quite there yet. But it's a really interesting example of where you might think that there's a policy that makes total sense, and then when you dig into a certain population, so the LGBTQ community, the policy that seemed really obvious and normal suddenly doesn't make sense. And then you know, your example of different countries as well is another really good example.
I just like to add to that. I agree. Like, I think when it comes to like the nipple, it doesn't make sense that a man would be allowed and a woman wouldn't be. And it's like, what if we just left both up or take both down? So it's like, okay, well, at least there's some level of equality instead of just like one is being, because either way, like, it would be sexualized, right? Like, if somebody wanted to sexualize the male body, it will be sexualized. So it doesn't make sense that we think, oh, because a male person is shirtless, that it can't be sexualized. Because I think that's always the baseline of, oh, it's nudity and it can be sexualized at some point. But I think either either gender can be sexualized. So it's such a weak argument to make. And also just like another point for the patriarchy, basically, because it's like, once again, the woman's body is being policed. And now, women have to wear certain garments and certain things when men just have like the freedom to just go around and, you know, be shirtless regardless, right? So I think it's definitely, you know, just like in every tech policy drafting situation, like we also have to go deeper into like, you know, what is the genesis of this policy? What is the moral standing of this policy? Are we actually, you know, being fair, rational, or are we just leaning into morals and trying not to, you know, rock the boat? But like something like Grindr, I feel like you even have, hopefully some have, you know, more leeway because it is an app, 18 plus, like literally, or like apps like TikTok where obviously we're dealing with the much younger users every now and then. And it's like, what should we be allowing? And we also don't want to be like the moral police. So there's a lot of questions to ask, but I think the more we have these conversations, it's better to just like see what other people are thinking and how best to pull in the ideas to draft a really good policy moving forward.
It can get so complicated, I think. And especially, yeah. I love what you said about thinking about ethics and morals and what is behind the policy that you're making. It's so easy to think about, oh, this is just how it is. But why is it this way?
Why exactly? You know, we don't really think about it. We just, and then obviously comes confirmation bias where it's like, okay, yeah, because of XYZ. So immediately, right? So it's just like, I know when I was, you know, as a manager, I would always like, speak to moderators. I'm like, we need to question our biases. Like sometimes it just creeps up without even us knowing. But then it's like, okay, take a step back. I'm like, based on the policy, based on what we're seeing now, what do we need to do and how do we need to move forward instead of just going based on what is and what isn't. So yeah, it's definitely something that has to be done training wise. Yeah,
that's a really good point. There's two sides of policy. There's what do the users see, which is community guidelines, mm-hmm. and how are those set up in the app, and what are the reporting features and educational components. But then the other side of it is moderation. Mm-hmm. And how are the moderators trained, and what do they need to know? And that's often actually the most detailed section. So moderators get many more examples, many more details, much deeper mm-hmm. dives than the public does most of the time. And I think that's something that most people probably don't think about or don't realize mm-hmm. that there's much more behind it.
Yeah, there is.
Do you have any examples of a policy that ended up being much more complicated than you thought that it would be, or somewhere where you started doing the research and then just kept going and going and going?
Yeah. I will say, like, when it comes to racial ambiguity, that has definitely been a hard topic. That, and also even just like body positivity. I think I can even start off with body positivity because I feel like that's an easier pill to swallow. So when we talk about body positivity, right? There are a lot of women now that would come on the platforms and talk about like their bodies, and you know, certain times we've seen that women who are plus size would be, you know, their videos would be taken down, right? And then someone who would probably just, you know, wear the same outfit just because they're slimmer, you know, regular size, their videos are still left off. And it's, you know, we've definitely seen a lot of outcry around that, and just like a lot of questions on like, okay, why was this video taken down? You know, what was the rationale around it? Is it because they have a bigger bust size, or, you know, so that has definitely been a problem. And like, the more you dig deeper, it's like, okay, if we take this video down, that means we'd also have to take down you know, videos of, you know, regular bodies. And then when it now comes to like swimsuits, right? The Victoria models, the Fenty, the Savage Fentys, when they come on the platform and they want to advertise, right? Do we leave those up? Because obviously they're gonna advertise both plus size, both regular size, that kind of stuff. So when those type of videos come up on the platform, or, you know, ads come up, What do we do? Do we kick them up? Do we leave them down? Because we already have a policy saying we're not going to allow this swimsuits kind of thing categories. So it's definitely been tricky. And we also don't want to be a platform that, you know, as policy managers, we don't want to draft policies that doesn't allow for body positivity, right? But then again, you know, another argument to come that, okay, somebody could sexualize this type of video, someone could sexualize this type of content. So where do we draw the line? How do we say, okay, this video is trying to promote body positivity and this video isn't? So yeah, that has definitely been a hot topic. I think even across different companies, I think Lizzo, for example, the artist, definitely went through a lot because of that. You know, her message has definitely been around body positivity, but a lot of companies have definitely misconstrued, some moderators, policies, whatever it is, have really misconstrued the message and saw it as sexual. And obviously because she's, you know, plus size, and a lot of questions around that. So it's like, okay, what do we need to do? And so quite frankly, even just talking about it now, I don't really have the best answer. So that's definitely something that has definitely got me in the weeds in the past. It's okay, what is really the best approach, like what precedent do we need to set? And then, you know, we're also working with companies who are deeply involved in body positivity. Like, how do you approach us when you want to, you know, create ads, for example, and what policy do we need to keep in place? So I think this is where we start creating more exceptions. And then also, again, working with organizations and having this kind of conversations to understand, like, when a woman is trying to promote body positivity and then, I don't know, sexualize herself, is there a difference? There be a difference, and what are the qualifiers that we need to look out for? So that is definitely something that got me in the weeds, and quite frankly, I think most policy managers listening to this will still be having a hard time trying to figure that out.
A really good example of something that we haven't figured out as a society yet. And so yeah. Policy managers are tasked with figuring it out before everybody else has. Let's get into tech policy a little bit deeper. Localized policies is one example of things that you've done, but what else do policy managers work on? What else do they do? What's encompassed by tech policy in general?
Well, it really depends on, like, I guess, what area of tech policy, because I always thought that tech policy is so, it's broad, even though we're like under the umbrella that is trust and safety, but you know, there are different types of policy managers. So it really depends on like your interests and what your strengths are. So for example, as a policy manager, I was more of a local policy manager, right? Like I was just, you know, kind of head in the weeds and everything Africa. So if something came that wasn't from my region, I might take it on, but it's not going to be like my first priority. So that's one, depending on the company, right? So if you have like, if anyone listening has an interest on like localized policies, context, you know, diversity and inclusion, trying to ensure that policies are more diverse, I feel like these type of roles will be best suited to you. Now there are what we call global policy managers or vertical policy managers or issue policy managers. So if you look at the community guidelines, they break them down into verticals. So depending on the company, some companies have 8, some companies have 7, 9, it really depends. So ranging from hate speech to illegal goods and activities, sexual content, minor safety. So these are the various verticals that exist. And some companies tend to hire based on those verticals. So there are people who have studied hate speech. Like I've met people who have school at Harvard, you know, Ivy Leagues, and their whole thesis was just based on hate speech. What does that look like? You know, how do people interact with hate speech? How do people interact with misinformation? Like when COVID was a huge deal, there was a lot of misinformation around the COVID. And so I know we've, you know, in my previous roles, we've had to hire people who have actually taken the time to understand even the history of misinformation and why it's being spread at an alarming rate. So if that is something that interests people, like there's a whole bucket where you can just come in and give a very high level, you know, introduction into these topics and draft policies accordingly. So these will definitely be more global policies and global standings of the company. Another thing is also like platform policies, right? So every company has different features. You know, a good example for, you know, like looking at, let's say Instagram, there are reels, there's audio, there are the search buttons, there's the live, there are just so many features and each day they come up with something new, right? So depending on what you're interested in, if it's something that, okay, you've always enjoyed live, you know, just beware, live is very on demand. And, you know, it's just been very unfortunate, just the type of really bad content we've seen in the, you know, previous years, like live shooting, for example, you know, the church crisis in New Zealand. So this type of issues is like, it's very on demand because it's happening live. So how do you react? How do you respond? And so if you're somebody who, you know, doesn't mind that on-demand nature, you're able to like quickly work and draft policies and or work closely with law enforcement. There are, you know, buckets of platform policy managers ranging from live to audio to search, depending on the company and the features that they have. Companies tend to hire policy managers for those specific features. And so that is just like tech policy. And then we just kind of move to public policy, right? Public policy in a way is tech policy, but they work with the government. So that, if you're interested in like working with the government, being the face of the company, when government is trying to scrutinize the companies, by all means, like you, I think communication is something that is key. It's not that daunting, but you just need to know how well to deal with government officials. Because these days, you know, governments are definitely clamping down. There are a lot of new laws coming up from the GSA to the online safety bills and so many others. And so public policy managers need to be very aware of just how well the companies are trying to implement it. What is the best approach? How do we get, you know, good standing lobbyists, that kind of thing. So these are examples of the different buckets and facets that tech policy tends to handle. And they are definitely more. I think these ones are just the most popular or front-facing nowadays, just because of the high demand of safety initiatives that are really required for companies. I feel like there's a lot of pressing need to protect users and protect, you know, user rights. So now there's like, okay, these four we definitely need. And as you can see online, there's a lot of like hiring calls. So people are interested. I think like just even typing the words like, you know, live safety manager or public policy manager or platform policy manager, it really just depends on how the user search keywords, you will definitely find roles and, you know, see that they are hiring in different companies.
And that's one of your specialties, is kind of helping to talk to people about how to get roles in these companies. So what tips do you have for people who are listening to this and saying, okay, all of this sounds fascinating, I want to get a job in tech policy. What are your tips?
Well, my first tip would always be like networking. I think for me, it's the most underrated tool or skill people tend to like overlook. They think, okay, well, I'm qualified, I know XYZ, I'm just going to click apply to these jobs. And, you know, in a fair society, it would work. But I think we just have to be very honest with ourselves. Like, even though I can't say, oh, life is unfair or society is unfair, it's just that there are so many applications that come in. And unfortunately, we're not dealing with applicant tracking system that already just weeds people out without even looking beyond their first name. There's already a lot of conversation around the biases based on these systems. So in order to put your best foot forward, the first thing I would say is like, you know, networking, knowing people in the space. So let me just like narrow it down to, for example, Google. If you saw a role that was like a policy analyst or policy enforcement manager, and you're interested in it, the first thing you want to do is find people who are actually in the same job title and reach out to them. Like, you know, I also will have a rule of five, reach out to these people, ask them like, hey, look, I can see that the company is hiring. I would love to know more about the job, and try to get referrals. Like a lot of companies work on referral systems. Like it's an incentive to employees. If somebody gets hired, they get a bonus. So it's also in their interest to help you out really and truly, right? So it's just how you approach them. And then once you get a sense of their day-to-day, which is also a good thing, because you don't want to see a role, get excited, and then get into the job and you're like, oh my gosh, this is not what I actually planned for. So many of times these, these informational interviews help you to understand what the day-to-day looks like. what you need to, how you need to put your best foot forward for the interviews, that kind of stuff. And then if they're gracious enough, they can refer you to the job. So that would be the first thing I would say. The second thing is also just like, you know, putting yourself out there. Attracting opportunities is also another way. When you're, you know, talking about tech policy, when you're talking about, you don't really have to know per se, you don't have to be an expert. But even just the news, there's always something going on in the tech policy realm. And so whenever you come online and discuss it, and like, even if it's just to call for comments or calling for, or you're just posing a question and you're calling for answers, right? It attracts people to your profile. If you have a LinkedIn profile, Twitter profile, whatever it is. And you know, you begin to realize that like recruiters are reaching out to you and asking you to like, you know, join a specific company or interview for a particular role. And so that is one way to attract people to your profile. And then when it comes to the interview itself, because people usually get to that point and ask, oh, how do I interview? I think it's just like, you need to know the policies in and out, the community guidelines. These companies have blog posts, they have safety newsrooms, whatever they call it, to say, oh, this is what we're doing, this is how we're addressing XYZ. So you need to understand how these companies are handling certain things. So for example, how would Google handle misinformation or fake news could be a bit different from how Facebook would or Snapchat, whatever the companies are. So you need to know how they're doing this. Informational interviews also help, but reading their blog posts, seeing what they're currently doing or what they're, you know, undergoing, whether it's a policy rechange or a law reform, definitely helps you to understand. And when you get to these interviews, you plan for scenarios which they will throw at you, and then, you know, work, you know, accordingly and say, okay, well, based on what they've already done, based on the precedent that you already have, this is what you're going to do. So that's what I usually tell people. You know, and the tech policy space is growing. There's no hard and fast rule of which your background is. You only need to have a legal or policy background. Nope. Most people that I know that are in tech policy, they don't have the traditional, I don't know if there is a traditional one, but most people have such a diverse background. So it just means that anyone who's interested in this space can actually land a role in the space. So that's what I would close it off on for anyone who's like interested in breaking into the space.
Yeah, for me, what I look for, and I've never, just to be totally clear, I've never hired a policy person because I've always been the policy person. I work at these small companies where we don't have policy departments. So I write the policies and I consult and work with everybody else in the trust and safety team. And we kind of collectively own policy. We don't have a policy person full time. But in general, when I'm hiring trust and safety roles, I definitely look at people who are really passionate about the work and have done the research and are total nerds in the space about whatever it is. And I think that is, I think the right thing to focus on, or the, you know, the most important part. Maybe not everybody needs a law degree like you have.
Exactly. I don't think so. Right. No, I totally agree, because like tech policy, when you break it down, it's just like protecting user rights. Like how we want to, the aim of trust and safety tech policy is to keep people safe. So it's like, you just need to show that you're passionate about that. You need to show that, look, I want to be on this team to protect users. Like, you know, and if you might even have a personal story where like you or somebody you know was close to you was affected by this, and this is what, you know, drives you. Because I feel like every tech policy professional or any trust safety person is like, we're also mission driven. It's not really about the profit, it's not really about the gains, it's just about protecting users. So if you can show that interest, whether it's in your interview or even just online, I think people can feel people's passion and like, okay, something that he or she's passionate about. So that's something I'm always like you said, if I was going to interview someone, I would definitely look out for the passion that they have to protect users online.
One thing you mentioned, doing these informational interviews, which is a great tip, is to see what a day in the life is like. What's a day in the life like for you? What kinds of things are you working on or thinking about? And it doesn't have to be your current job, because I know that you just started.
Yeah, so new. I know, right?
But you know, at a previous role, what does a typical day look like?
Exactly. I can start real like briefly on like my current role, because I feel like I haven't really spoken much about it. So So right now, like, I'm a project manager at the Oversight Board, an Oversight Board being like an independent body that's currently handling appeals, you know, from Facebook. So if there's a video taken down, or, you know, people have certain questions about the decision, the Oversight Board might decide to take on the appeal. So as a project manager, so to anybody listening, just to let you know that there are like so many, well, not so many, but there are a lot of rules that are beyond policy. And so far I've been able to, I guess, dabble into these various roles, and they're still under that whole trust and safety bucket. So as a project manager, as anybody would know, it's, you know, just basically doing different projects, handling and working with different stakeholders. So my day-to-day, hopefully, once I'm more ramped up, would definitely be understanding the big goal of the projects that we're working on, and, you know, knowing the various stakeholders, how to make sure that we're all aligned, and, you know, making sure we're hitting timelines and targets. And because of my background in policy, trust and safety, legal, it's easier to identify these stakeholders. It's easier to identify and be realistic about the timelines, because you're like, oh yeah, this project can be 1 month. You're like, no, you're gonna need 3 months to do this, trust me. So that is kind of what my day-to-day is gonna look like. And just taking a step back, as a policy manager, my day-to-day was, it was mostly like putting off fires, really a dream. it was like waking up and somebody just jumped off a train because it's a challenge or something. And it's, you know, also stakeholder management. I think that, you know, definitely prepared me for this role, because as a policy manager in many companies, you are like the middle man or woman dealing with so many stakeholders who are going to ask you questions and be like, what do we do now? La, la, la. You know, there's PR, comms, public policy, senior leadership, operations team. They're all going to be asking different types of questions. And it's your job to, first of all, keep them calm and be like, okay, this is what I need, you know, I need from all of you. And this is what we're going to do moving forward. And so it's also being like a real good decision maker. Well, not really good, like the pressure isn't really on you, but you need to know how to make certain decisions and also stand behind it. Like, obviously you're going to have a good manager who definitely supports you, but you also need to learn how to, you know, not waver on your decision, because sometimes it will happen and you're like, oh my gosh, am I really correct here? So, you know, you have to be, you know, you've done the work, right? They hired you for certain reasons. So don't let imposter syndrome come in and be like, oh yeah, I'm not sure. Like, you know, they know why they hired you. And so you kind of need to make decisions based on that. So that's what my day-to-day kind of look like. And also understanding new policies as they come in. So when new laws come in, it's like, okay, do we need to update our current policies? Do we need to take out this policy entirely? What do we need to do as the, you know, the user base is growing? What type of changes do we need to make? So there will always be reiterations of policies. No policy is stagnant to the end of the company. So depending on how the company works, maybe every 3 months is an evaluation, every 6 months, it really depends. And so your job is to come in and, you know, work as a consultant and be okay, based on the existing policies, what we need to do to update it. And then also, if you want to create a new policy, you need to like have a lot of backing and research and, okay, based on what we're seeing and the trends, you know, make a good place so that obviously senior leadership can sign off on it. And then you can have a new policy based on whatever trends that you've seen. So that's what the day-to-day of a policy manager looks like. And if you find it interesting, feel free to reach out to me. I'm more than happy to like walk you through. And if project management also seems interesting, you know, same, you know, feel free to reach out, and then more than happy to walk you through what that looks like.
That is very generous of you. How can people get in touch with you if they have questions?
Well, my LinkedIn is the best. So it's literally just my first name and my last name. I tend to check my LinkedIn messages a lot, although this month might be tricky. just trying to give myself grace to settle into a new role in a new country. But yes, LinkedIn definitely works. I'm more than happy. And I do hope to be hosting, like, because I usually host like monthly sessions with people. Like, I've had groups of like 300 people, 200 people online, and I would just like have a whole class, like 1 hour, 15, 30 minutes, just walk them through the basics of, okay, this is where you need to know about trust and safety. This is what you need to know about tech policy, or even just getting a job. right? So that's something that I hope to do, because I know I can't accommodate one-to-ones as much. So definitely be on the lookout for these monthly sessions. And yeah, and if you do have questions, like personally, like I definitely would try to make my calendar more open to that in the near future.
Great. Well, thank you so much for talking with me about all of this. Hopefully it's helpful for people who have thought about tech policy a little bit, but want a bit of a deeper dive into what it's like and some career tips. I know I've had a lot of questions from people around this topic. So thank you so much, Perle. It was really great talking to you.
Yes, thank you so much. Thank you to everyone that listened as well.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please share this episode with your friends. It helps us continue making more episodes for you. Today's episode was produced by Talha Baig. I'm Alice Hensberger. Music by Zhao Shen. Special thanks to everyone at the Integrity Institute for their continued support.